Hello, I'm Sebastian. Welcome to Nine Archery's podcast. Today, I will summarize and review the book, In a Consumer's Republic, The Politics of Mass Consumption in Postwar America. Historian Elizabeth Cohen examines how buying, housing, credit, and retail development became central to American public life after World War II. Rather than treating consumer abundance as a background feature of the 1950s and later decades, Cohen presents it as a political project with consequences for citizenship, liberalism, race, class, gender, and metropolitan space. Her account follows the transition from the wartime ideal of the citizen consumer, whose spending choices were connected to collective national needs, to a post-war order in which economic growth and personal purchasing power were widely treated as foundations of democracy. Drawing on social, political, cultural, and urban history, she links federal policy to everyday settings such as suburbs, shopping centers, and households. The book's purpose is not simply to criticize consumer culture. It explains why mass consumption acquired such authority, how it offered genuine security and participation to many Americans, and why its unequal distribution intensified social divisions and reshaped political priorities. I will give you key takeaways from this book. Firstly, the post-war citizen was recast as a consumer. Cohen's central argument is that post-war Americans increasingly understood citizenship through consumption. During the Depression and World War II, policymakers and reformers often described consumers as members of a public whose welfare required price regulation, fair distribution, and economic planning. After 1945, however, a different ideal gained force. Prosperous private consumers, exercising choice in a growing marketplace, would sustain employment, stabilize capitalism, and demonstrate the superiority of American democracy. This was more than a change in advertising or household aspiration. It altered the language through which rights and social progress were debated. Access to homes, appliances, automobiles, and credit could appear as evidence that citizens were receiving their due, while political problems were often reframed as matters of purchasing opportunity. Cohen does not claim that politics disappeared into shopping. Instead, she shows that consumption became a major arena through which people evaluated government, asserted status, and pursued security. The shift also narrowed the meaning of collective provision. A society organized around broad public goods can address needs through shared institutions. One organized around private consumption places greater weight on each household's market capacity. Thus, the consumer-citizen ideal contained both a democratic promise of wider abundance and a structural vulnerability. Citizens without equal income, credit, mobility, or access to desirable markets could not participate on equal terms. Secondly, federal policy helped build a private mass consumption economy. The book emphasizes that the consumer economy was not simply the spontaneous outcome of rising post-war incomes. Public policy helped construct the conditions under which private consumption could become the preferred route to security and prosperity. Federal commitments to housing finance, mortgage support, highway building, and education expanded opportunity for many families while encouraging a suburban, home-centered model of economic life. These policies connected citizenship to assets and consumption. A house could provide shelter, social standing, and wealth. An automobile could make dispersed jobs and retail districts accessible. Consumer credit could make desired goods available sooner. Cohen's analysis complicates a familiar contrast between an active New Deal state and a supposedly private post-war marketplace. The state remained deeply involved, but its interventions often worked by supporting private ownership, private purchasing, and decentralized metropolitan development. This arrangement could be politically attractive because it presented public assistance to markets as individual advancement, rather than collective redistribution. Yet its benefits were unevenly available. Eligibility rules, lending practices, local governance, and residential segregation shaped who could obtain favorable mortgages, accumulate home equity, or reach new suburban opportunities. Cohen therefore treats the post-war consumption regime as a policy architecture, not merely a cultural mood. Its political importance lies in the way government action made private consumption seem like the normal measure of social inclusion. Thirdly, suburbanization and shopping centers reorganized social space. Cohen gives the built environment unusual importance. Suburbs, highways, planned developments, and shopping centers were not neutral containers for consumer activity. They organized who could meet, travel, buy, work, and belong. The post-war shopping center and later mall offered convenience and a carefully managed setting for consumption, often replacing or competing with older urban commercial districts. Their appeal rested partly on promises of safety, parking, order, and choice. But those apparent conveniences also reflected a metropolitan shift of investment, tax resources, and retail activity towards suburban areas. Cohen uses this spatial transformation to challenge the idea that post-war affluence benefited all places in the same way. As households and businesses moved outward, many central cities faced a weakened commercial base and heightened fiscal and social pressures, Access to the new consumer landscape depended on residents and transportation, making mobility a political as well as practical resource. The suburban ideal also encouraged a more privatized social life, centered on the household and its possessions. Cohen does not reduce suburban residents to passive consumers. People used these spaces for community life and political action as well. Her point is that spatial design and development policy set the terms on which such action occurred. A history of mass consumption must therefore account for landscapes, not just products, because landscapes distribute opportunity and make particular forms of citizenship easier to practice than others. Fourthly, race and class determined access to consumer citizenship. A Consumer's Republic argues that the expansion of mass consumption was inseparable from inequalities in race and class. The post-war promise of a broadly prosperous consumer society was powerful, precisely because it suggested that ordinary families could attain security through wages, homes, and durable goods. In practice, that promise was distributed through labor markets, residential patterns, lending systems, and local institutions that did not treat all Americans equally. Discrimination in housing and credit, along with segregation and unequal access to well-paying employment, restricted many Black Americans' ability to gain the property and suburban access that became markers of full consumer citizenship. Class differences also mattered. Consumer abundance depended on stable earnings and the ability to assume debt, conditions not shared by all workers. Cohen's framework is valuable because it avoids viewing inequality as an unfortunate side effect of an otherwise universal prosperity. The mechanisms that expanded private consumption, especially homeownership and suburban development, could create and preserve advantage across generation through property values and public investment. Civil rights struggles consequently had a consumer dimension. Equal citizenship involved more than formal legal rights. It also concerned access to housing, retail spaces, credit, and the material resources increasingly associated with membership in the national community. By linking consumer policy to racial and class stratification, Cohen explains why post-war disparity could coexist with persistent exclusion and increasingly divided urban-suburban politics. Lastly, consumer activism tested the limits of marketplace democracy. Cohen also traces efforts to make consumer power serve broader democratic ends. Consumer advocates sought protections involving product safety, truthful information, fair prices, and corporate accountability, particularly as the scale and complexity of the marketplace made individual choice an insufficient safeguard. These movements reveal an important tension in the post-war order. If citizenship was expressed through purchasing, then consumers needed meaningful protections to exercise that role. Yet treating consumers primarily as isolated buyers could weaken attention to collective inequalities that markets could not resolve. The consumer rights politics associated with the later 20th century thus carried both reformist potential and limitations. It could pressure businesses and government to recognize consumers as a public with legitimate claims. At the same time, it could leave intact an economic system in which political standing depended heavily on purchasing power. Cohen's analysis does not dismiss consumer activism as trivial. Instead, it asks what kind of democratic politics it produced and what problems it could not solve. Protections for buyers are consequential, but they do not by themselves guarantee equal access to income, housing, transportation, or public services. This distinction helps explain the book's larger critique of post-war liberalism policy, increasingly promised inclusion through private consumption. Even when durable equality required stronger collective solutions, consumer activism is therefore presented as both evidence of democratic engagement and a window onto the boundaries of consumer-centered citizenship. In conclusion, A Consumer's Republic is especially valuable for readers seeking to understand post-war United States history beyond familiar images of prosperity, suburbs, and television advertising. Students and scholars of American history, political science, urban studies, sociology, architecture, cultural studies, and public policy will find its interdisciplinary method particularly useful. It also rewards general readers who want historical context for current arguments about household debt, homeownership, retail decline, suburban inequality, consumer protections, and the political meaning attached to individual choice. The book's practical intellectual benefit is its insistence on tracing everyday economic life back to institutions and policy. It equips readers to ask not only what people bought, but who could buy, what public decisions made that possible, and what forms of exclusion were built into the arrangement. What distinguishes Cohen's work from broad histories of post-war affluence or consumer culture is its sustained integration of political ideology with a material geography of metropolitan America. Consumption is not treated as a superficial cultural phenomenon or a simple consequence of prosperity. It is analyzed as a framework for citizenship, supported by government action and embedded in homes, roads, retail spaces, and credit systems. The book also resists a one-dimensional verdict consumer abundance, could expand comfort and opportunity while simultaneously shifting social obligations into private markets and deepening racial and spatial inequality. That combination of archival depth, conceptual ambition, and attention to the built environment makes it a durable account of how consumer capitalism shaped the terms on which many Americans came to imagine democracy itself. If you would like to support Lizabeth Cohen, you can buy the book through the Amazon link I've provided in the podcast description. After reading the book, please let me know what you think and share your thoughts. See you around.